From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
You know, everyone writes to-do lists. This is a really short one, just three items on it. To-do, email Corey, introduce him to lesbians, and continue to convince self that I'm not madly in love with him.
It's Davy Rothbart, editor of Found Magazine, reading one of the strange but true scraps of paper that somebody found and sent to him. Today we'll talk about things lost and found, from rediscovered diaries to an isolated Stone Age tribe found in the Philippine wilderness. Also the story of Pete Best, the original drummer for the Beatles, his replacement Ringo Starr found fame and fortune. And Pete Best, he spent most of his life working as a civil servant in Liverpool.
Liverpoolians are outspoken. They'll look across the desk and turn around and say, "Aren't you the so-and-so who played for the Beatles? You know, what the hell are you doing working in the job centre?"
Won't you please, please help me, help me, help me.
Davy Rothbart collects stuff. Stuff that other people have lost or thrown out. Scraps of paper, shopping lists, photos, diaries. He reprints the best stuff in Found Magazine, and word is spreading about this collection of oddball material, so more and more people send him stuff they've found. Davy Rothbart recently stopped by our studio with a stack of recent finds, including this list of instructions.
Beat up a pillow, hide from yourself, brush hair wrong way, run into a wall, pretend you're on a talk show, tape mouth, spin, clean up.
Good instructions. Where did you find this?
It was found in Boulder, Colorado, by someone I don't know, and they sent it to me. People are sending me their finds from all over the country.
Do people just send you stuff all the time?
Yes, flooded with it, and it's wonderful, because every day I go out to my mailbox, there's 5 or 10 pieces of paper, photographs, anything that people have found. I always end up just standing at the mailbox, opening them right then. Love notes, to-do lists, hate notes.
So how did you get started doing this?
I always loved finding stuff. You know, even when I was a kid, I remember I used to walk across this kind of debris-strewn ball field to get to the school bus. And there was all these notes and papers, photographs, you know, swirling around. I would just pick them up. And I was always kind of amazed at how powerfully you could connect with someone just through a little, you know, half-page love note sitting there in the grass. And, you know, you could really feel the person that had written it. And I always save the stuff. I always love saving it. And then there was, I think, one note in particular that kind of moved me from, you know, just doing it as a hobby to wanting to share it with everybody. Uh-huh. And it's this note here that I actually found in Chicago on the windshield of my car. It was kind of a snowy night, and I came out of my friend's apartment. My name's Davy, but this note on my windshield was addressed to Mario. And it said, "Mario, I hate you. You said you had to work? Then why's your car here at her place? You're a liar. I hate you. I hate you. Amber. P.S. Page me later."
And I mean, you have an immediate sense of Mario and Amber's relationship.
Yes,
don't you?
Exactly. The whole thing is flushed out for you. I mean, and the fact that she put it on the wrong car.
Right.
I mean, he wasn't even guilty, at least not that night, you know, but there is more story to it, because you feel like if she was that quick to suspect him,
uh-huh,
he must have had a pattern of showing up at this, you know, other girl's house. To me, it was something that, you know, it had all these complex emotions in it. You know, she's so angry, so betrayed, but still kind of in love with him. And
there's a powerful strain of emotion going through almost all of this stuff. But of course, that's because people send you stuff that says something. They don't send you the grocery list that has the lettuce and the tomatoes and the grapes crossed off.
Right, right. I figured out, actually, my little brother, who's a great finder, he figured out the percentages. He says 4 out of 5 are, you know, just ATM receipts, something like that. Nothing too interesting, but he said it's been scientifically calculated by him that 1 in 5, 20% of all finds are gems. And I think that pretty much holds true, you know. Found shopping lists, I think, are really funny, because when you're at the registers at the supermarket and you look down, there's always a couple floating around there, and it's interesting to see what people have bought before you. I have one favorite. It's so short, but I really like the way it goes together. It says, "Batteries, roach spray, watermelon." And then, funniest of all to me are these shopping lists that only contain one item, because, you know,
you'd think you could remember one thing.
Exactly.
You're not old enough to understand yet.
Oh, is that how it goes? I just can't imagine walking out of the store, having gone about one thing, and being like, "Wait, with nothing, you know, walking out with nothing and say, oh, I think I forgot something.
No, no, the problem is when you walk in the front door and you say, I don't know why I came here.
Right. I mean, a lot of these notes have just a fragment of a story. You know, each one's kind of a riddle. So often we encounter stories that are kind of, they're wrapped up in a neat little bow. You know, they have these tidy resolutions. And for me, all these notes are kind of fascinating because the story's unfinished, you know, and it's left to you to try to piece together what's going on. And I found that even, you know, two different people can look at the same found note and come away with a totally different idea of what's happening for the people in the note, you know.
Some of them, as you say, are poignant.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned one before we got started about a diary.
Yes. Well, actually, I like the story of where it was found. A woman was on her way home from work, and she saw on the curb, she saw a big pile of trash, and next to it was this big, beautiful chair that had been put out for the garbage man to take away. So she pulled over, threw the chair in the trunk of her car, and just decided to look in these boxes that were there. And there were all these old handwritten letters, all these photographs. As she's looking through the box, this garbage truck whirls around the corner. Two guys jump off the back of it. They're kind of looking at her. She's looking at them. She just plunges her hand in, pulls one little booklet out of the box and hops in her car, drives away. So she gets home and takes this new found chair and puts it on her front porch and sits in it to read this thing that she's grabbed. And it turns out to be a young girl's journal from November of 1963.
A month that a lot of people remember.
Yes. And so, you know, she's sitting in her new chair and opens it up to the first, it's a journal, and the first entry is Friday, November 22nd, 1963. The girl has begun each journal entry, Dear Tammy. She signs each one with her name, Nadine. So the first entry on November 22nd says, Dear Tammy, today the president was killed. Isn't that terrible? At school, everyone was crying, except the Republicans. President Kennedy was killed by a guy named Harry Oswald. He says he didn't do it, but he did. Tomorrow's John's birthday. And then it goes on from there. You know, Saturday, November 23rd, 1963. Dear Tammy, there will be no school Monday because President Johnson has declared it a national day of mourning for President Kennedy. I stayed overnight at Jerry's today because it was John's birthday. We babysat for the next door neighbors until 12:30. Boy, that baby's a brat. There hasn't been much news about the assassination of President Kennedy. I don't think it'll be much fun having an extra day off because you can't watch TV or radio because it's all news. And then finally, Sunday, November 24th, 1963. Dear Tammy, guess what? The assassinator got assassinated. Yep, Harry Oswald got killed. I think it serves him right. Today on TV, they played the national anthem on a program which was dedicated to the late President Kennedy, and I ran into the kitchen because I was crying. Nadine.
Wow.
So, I mean, the woman who found this, she really did rescue this from oblivion. I think it's a noble act for people to pick the stuff up off the street and save it and just, you know, save these human lives that are behind them.
Do you ever feel like a voyeur?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a certain degree of voyeurism is healthy. You know, like, we're surrounded by strangers all the time, on the bus, walking down the street. I think it's only natural to be curious about what, you know, what other people's experience of being human is like.
That's true. When you sit on the bus and you look at the guy across from you or the lady who's standing with her grocery bags and you're feeling as though you really ought to get up and give her your seat.
Right.
But you
don't. And you're riding along, gazing at them and kind of wondering what's going on in their minds and hearts. And I think that's what these notes offer us, you know, sort of a direct link right inside their heads. And
I just like to assure everybody who's listening that I always do get up and...
Sure you do, Jim.
Show me another one.
There's a ransom note here, Jim. this was found in Milwaukee. And it's the first ransom note we'd ever, you know, anyone had ever found and sent it to us.
Did you send a copy to the FBI?
I should. I need to do that. I mean, it's typed out. You know, obviously the perpetrators wanted to remain anonymous.
Okay. And this is just a copy, so.
Yes. So it says, AJ, we have your binder. You will never see it again unless you leave a sum of $3.50 directly under the clock to the left of the door at precisely 1:15. Please do not inform any teacher of this transaction. If you mess this up, you will regret it. P.S. If you do not comply, then you will never see your binder again.
$3.50.
Hefty fee.
Yeah. Read another one to me.
Sure.
You've got a stack of them.
Well, here's one that's interesting. It's a kid writing to his mom. It says, Dear Mom, I miss you. I really wish you were here. There's been a lot of bad stuff in my life, but I'm sure you already know that. But there's also been some really good things, like Sean. He's my best friend, and so is Brittany. Hey, Mom, guess what's the best part of all? There's a girl. Her name is Kim. We've been dating for about a month and a half now. I love her so much. I know if you were here, you would like her a lot. She makes me so happy. There's nobody I've ever been more happier with. I love this girl more than she could ever imagine, Mom. I would die for this girl. Well, Mom, I got my license this summer, so I can be out here every day. So yeah, I got to go. I love you so much, Mom. I'll write you again. Bye. Your son, Chris. P.S. Brian misses you too. And, you know, some of the story of the notes is where they were found. And
so the woman
that found this note, this kid writing to his mom, she found it in a cemetery. She was in the cemetery, and there's this big old oak tree in the middle of the place. And up in the highest branches, she saw this little helium balloon. Its ribbon was caught around a branch. And dangling from the ribbon was a little note. So she scaled all the way up the tree, brought the balloon down, and unfolded the note. And this was it. So you can just picture this, this kid visiting his mom, visiting the cemetery, and sending a note up to her in a balloon.
Davy Rothbart is the founder and editor of Found Magazine. If you want to see more samples from Found Magazine, you'll find a link on our website at www.ttbook.org. Later this hour, we'll hear another lost and found story, the unforgettable story of Hannah's suitcase, lost until some Japanese kids found it half a century later.
In the adult world, we hear a lot about Holocaust fatigue. I've heard it so many times, not another Holocaust story. That means nothing to these kids.
In 1971, David Brinkley announced a remarkable discovery on the NBC Nightly News.
The outside world, after maybe 1,000 years, has discovered a small tribe of people living in a remote jungle in the Philippines. Their way of living is approximately that of the Stone Age.
That tribe, the Tassadai, was called the anthropological discovery of the century. Then, 12 years later, the whole thing was denounced as a hoax. So, what's the real story? Writer Robin Hemley believes there's no easy answer. He's written a book about the Tassadai called Invented Eden. Hemley says it's partly a story about our own modern prejudices. As he told Steve Paulson, there was a breathless quality to those early descriptions of the Tassadai.
They were considered to have no contact with anyone outside the rainforest in southern Mindanao, completely isolated. They had no cloth. They wore leaves. They lived in caves. They had no metal technology, only stone tools. So they were basically like throwbacks in a way to 10,000 years ago. They were as close, supposedly, to our Stone Age ancestors as anyone.
Now, part of the appeal of this whole story is that it seemed that paradise on Earth had been discovered, that these were noble primitives.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, they seemed to be peaceful, unlike the Yanomamo in the Amazon, which we'd heard were very warlike.
Right. They were the antidote to the Yanomamo and sort of the antidote to us, because at the time, if you recall, this was 1971, 72, and the Vietnam War was still very much in everyone's living rooms, pretty much on TV. The standard sort of knowledge of who we had been, our Stone Age ancestors, was that, in the words of Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, their lives were nasty, short, and brutish. But the Tassadai seemed to have this sort of, you know, lovely idyll of a life. No outside enemies, no words for weapon or war. They spent just a couple of hours a day, supposedly, in food production and spent the rest of their lives, you know, bathing in waterfalls.
It sounds pretty nice.
Yeah.
Now, there was also something kind of mysterious about all of this, because there wasn't much access to these people.
Well, one of the main, or if not the main, impresario involving the Tassadai was a Marcos government minister named Manuel Elizalde Jr., or he was called Manda. And he pretty much kept a tight leash on access to the Tassadai. And partly that was, quote, to protect them, you know, because there were a lot of curiosity seekers. There were a lot of people who wanted in. And part of it was because he was just a very controlling type of person.
But there were a few disturbing details, at least the way you write about this, that suggested that maybe these people were not quite as isolated as they'd been made out to be. For instance, wasn't one woman wearing a cloth skirt?
Well, yes. Yes. In fact, the story is just full of contradictions and full of ambiguities. And that's what makes the story so fascinating, is that when Elizalde first met the Tassadai, he asked them at one point, well, did you always dress like this? They were dressed, some of them were dressed in cloth skirts and knot leaves and things like that. And they said, no, we didn't always dress like this. There was a hunter, a guy named Defal from a neighboring tribe who had had several years of contact with them prior to Elizalde coming in and supposedly gave them things, including the cloth and brass earrings and bolo knives and things like that. So they said, no, we didn't always dress like this. And so Elizalde said, well, can you show us how you used to dress? So they went upstream for a few minutes and then came back dressed in these sort of leaf G-strings and women wearing sort of leaf mini-skirts even, you know. And Elizalde reportedly said, well, that's lovely. Why don't you just wear those from now on?
You're supposed to look primitive.
Right, exactly. Now that moment I find really fascinating because it can be interpreted in three different ways, depending on your perspective. It can be interpreted as the beginning of a hoax. It can be interpreted as a kind of rhetoric of tribal pride. Elizalde was always preaching to the tribes to, you know, be proud of what they wore. Or it could be interpreted as a kind of enforced primitivism. And I think it's actually a combination of the latter two. It was as much a projection of Elizalde's fantasy of what he wanted them to be as anything. And also, I should say, of the wider Western world, what we wanted them to be.
Now, there were all these news reports that came out about the Tassadai in the early 70s. They kind of went on for a few years, and then they seemed to drop out of sight and disappeared for a number of years.
Yeah, well, they were sort of our entertainment for 2 years. What happened, though, was that after some aborted scientific forays and a lot of press reports, Elizalde and Marcos declared the 45,000-acre reserve that had been set aside for the Tassadai in the rainforest, declared it off-limits to outsiders. Said, well, let's just leave them alone, you know, just let them be. Sounded fine to everyone, so they let them be for 12 years. And then, in 1986, about 2 weeks after the Marcos government fell, a Swiss reporter named Oswald Eaton decided to go in and investigate the Tassadai, acting on a tip. He hiked in the company of a Filipino reporter and activist named Joey Lozano and met some Tassadai who were now dressed in Western garb, which, you know, it's not that unusual after, you know, 12 years that they'd be in T-shirts and so on. So then they told him through translators, supposedly, that in fact, they hadn't been these cave dwellers, that they'd been local farmers who'd been coerced into acting as cave people by Elizalde.
So the whole thing was a hoax.
Supposedly, yes. It was supposedly a hoax. And what made it even seem more of a hoax was that a week later, a group from the German magazine Stern came in acting on the same tip. But they came in a different way. They were led by the original, quote, discoverer, Defal, this hunter from the local tribe. And when they came to the caves, they found the same Tassadai that Oswald Eaton had photographed a week earlier, dressed in T-shirts and Levi's. Now they were wearing leaves again. Not only were they wearing leaves, but some of them had underwear poking out through the leaves. And one confused person was, one man was even wearing a leaf brassiere. I don't know why, but he was.
This is so bizarre.
It was bizarre.
And it's as if all these different people were kind of fighting over what the Tassadai meant.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it continues to some degree to this day. You know, when I heard that story, that was one of the first things I heard. And I said, well, this is great. This is a comedy. But as soon as I started digging a little deeper, doing a little research, I realized that it was much more complex. I met an anthropologist who'd spent 25 years with the Agda tribe of northern Luzon in the Philippines. And he told me that it wasn't that unusual for the Agda, when they had a visitor coming, to, quote, dress down, because they knew that that was what was expected of them. And they knew that sometimes economic benefits accrued, too. There's even a term in anthropology. Richard Fox coined a term, the professional primitive, that there are these groups who, they don't have to be coerced or told dress in leaves or whatever, but will do it when they have visitors.
And you could see they could benefit from that. I mean, the visitors will bring them stuff, will bring them goods, and it's kind of mutually beneficial.
And they get photographed and they get a lot of attention, and, you know, who doesn't like attention?
Now, you went there.
Yes.
And you actually went to those caves where the Tassadai lived. So what's your conclusion about all of this?
Well, the Tassadai were, I believe, forest dwellers. They were not paid actors, or they weren't coerced into being, you know, cave people. But neither were they Stone Age. They were definitely exaggerated, but I don't think they were a hoax by any means.
But the whole mystique had been that they were isolated from all the people around them were living like people thousands of years ago.
Well, that's bunk. You know, that's not the case. But no one's as isolated as we once thought. I mean, anthropologists made a lot of claims over the last how many years that they had found these truly isolated tribes, you know, the Kalahari Kung, who were made famous in the Gods Must Be Crazy films. They were supposedly hunter-gatherers who were isolated, and it was found out that they'd been trading with their agriculturalist neighbors for centuries, you know. And so, yes, these claims that were made of the Tassadai that they were isolated are not the case.
So it sounds like the story says more about us, I mean, about modern Westerners than about the Tassadai. It says a lot about our desire to find the noble savage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it says a lot about us in that way, about how we idealize and project our own fantasies on these small-scale societies, while at the same time kind of destroying them, you know, and using them as entertainments. And at the same time, it says a lot about our cynicism, too, because the hoax story was snapped up by the public just as eagerly as the original story. So, yeah, it says a lot about us. What it says about the Tassadai is mostly a pretty tragic story. I mean, they're this small group of people, this band of poor tribal people who have been exploited, I think, to some degree by both sides.
Robin Hemley, talking with Steve Paulson. Hemley's book is called Invented Eden, The Elusive, Disputed History of the Tassadai. In a minute, more in our Lost and Found show. We track down the Beatles' original drummer, Pete Best. How does it feel to be a historical footnote when the rest of your band became gods of the music world?
I think it's something you accept. And I think if you're content with what you're doing, you're happy with what you've achieved music-wise and what you've achieved family-wise, I think you've done well.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Recognize this song? It's one of the Beatles' early recordings, Hello Little Girl. You can hear John, Paul, George, and Pete. That's right, Pete Best, the Beatles' drummer before Ringo Starr. In fact, it was Pete's mother, Mona, who played a key role in the formation of the band. When she opened the Casbah Coffee Club in the basement of her house in Liverpool, she went looking for an opening night band. George Harrison and Ken Brown, recruited two old buddies, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They called themselves the Quarrymen. Not long after that, Pete Best became the group's drummer. Why Pete Best was kicked out of the band remains something of a mystery to this day, but one thing's clear. For Pete, the timing could not have been worse. Just a few months after he left the band in the summer of 62, the Beatles landed their first number one hit, Love Me Do, and they soon went on to make music history. And Pete Best? Well, he kicked around with a few bands before settling into a career as a civil servant in Liverpool. In 1988, Pete once again picked up his drumsticks and formed the Pete Best Band. And now he's put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. He told Steve Paulson that he joined the Beatles right before they went to Hamburg.
I got a phone call from Paul McCartney, which basically turned around and said, you know, we've got the offer to go to Germany. Would you be interested in taking over the drummer's role? And I said, yeah, I am interested, but I'll check it out with my own boys and, you know, my parents. They turned around and said, yes, if it's what you want to do, go with our blessings. And I phoned Paul back and turned around and said, yep, I'm in. And Paul turned around and said, well, yes, you might be in, but you've got to audition. And I went down the following day to the Wyvern Club, which later became the Blue Angel. My younger brother Rory was with me. I threw my drums in the taxi, got down there, played about six numbers that consisted of the audition. And after about 10 minutes, they went away in a corner, had a little bit of a tete-a-tete. And then they came back and turned around and said, Pete, you're in. And that's the way I acquired the drummer's role with the Beatles.
What kind of people were John, Paul and George?
George was the youngest guy. Even from, you know, the first instance, he was very much into wanting to improve his guitar technique. So he was rehearsing, practicing, making sure he wanted to be the best guitarist around. Paul, very much the PR orientated guy, wanted the public to know, the world to know what was happening. Again, a brilliant musician, very self-assured, very self-composed. John was the, I suppose you could turn around and say, the clown of the band. He had this sardonic, caustic-witted humour. And it was something which was, you know, I took a liking to because I became, you know, very close to John. But I actually saw another side of John, which was a very tender and a very loving side. And when you actually put those two components together, John was the complete person as far as I was concerned.
Now, you played with the Beatles for a couple of years, from 1960 to 62. How much of the Beatles' essential sound do you think was established during that period?
I think the vast majority of it, to be quite honest, simply because of the fact that, the kindred hours we put in, you know, the killing hours we did in Germany, that was the welding, that was the fusion. We were playing six, 7 hours a night, six, seven nights a week. You know, even if you didn't realise it, it was taking place. We were becoming tight, we were becoming energetic. The sound was improving, it was becoming more raw, it was becoming more powerhouse and more savage. The image was changing. And, of course, it was through that hard schooling in Hamburg. When we came back to Liverpool, you know, and we were doing exactly the same as we did in Hamburg, it just basically took the Liverpool audiences by storm. So really, you know, the sound and the creation, the early creation I'm talking about, took place during the, you know, those two kindred years.
Now, you played a lot of gigs with the Beatles, both in Liverpool and in Germany. Weren't you also, for a while, handling the books? You were actually the manager, in a sense?
Yes, I assumed the mantle prior to Brian Epstein, and I handled the business side of things.
One day in August of 1962, Brian Epstein told you that you were out. You were no longer going to be part of the Beatles, and Ringo Starr was going to replace you. Was this a complete surprise?
It was, simply because the fact there'd been no real forewarning at all about it. I'd been with the band for 2 years. We'd recorded with Polydor. We'd got the recording contract with the EMI. It did come as a complete surprise because, you know, all of this was taking place. We were on an upward roll. We decided on what our first release was going to be, which was Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You. But then I was called into the office around about mid August 1962, and one night I was a Beatle, and the next morning I was no longer there.
Why do you think that happened? Why were you fired?
I don't know. I mean, the reason that was given that I wasn't a good enough drummer has never held up water, never will, and there's lots of people in Liverpool who support me from that particular area, and even today, you know, travelling around the world and playing with my own band, the Pete Best Band, they've looked at my drumming ability and basically turned around and said, no, you have a style of your own, which was very credible. You know, you were rated and reputed to be one of the best drummers in Liverpool. We can see why. So that particular aspect of it never held up water.
Now, there have been a couple of other explanations that have been put forward. One is that the other Beatles were actually jealous of you because you were this good-looking guy and apparently a lot of the girls flocked around you. And another explanation is that you didn't quite fit in with the rest of the lads, that you held yourself a little bit separate.
I think that's hard to sort of swallow as well. Again, this is things which people sort of point out and they try and, you know, turn around and say that was the reason for it. They may have assumed it. Something which happened in Hamburg, people have got hold of it. I think in Hamburg, people turn around and said I was a little bit of a loner. I was alone simply because of the fact I was a drummer. I broke sticks. I used to have to go into town by myself. I was the one who used to get out of bed early, right? The others were still there. Sometimes we go into town together, but if, you know, if they weren't prepared to go into town, I had to need sticks. That used to be, you know, the only time that it was separate. If you turn around and say you didn't quite fit in, answer me one question. Why did it take them 2 years to suddenly realise that I couldn't have fitted in?
I understand a lot of fans in Liverpool were furious, and there were practically riots at some of the performances once Ringo was part of the band. People chanted, Pete forever, Ringo never.
Yes, that did happen. It was very heartwarming. You know, there was petitions sent to the Merseybeats. George Harrison got a black eye off an irate fan. Brian was threatened. Deep down inside, it was very heartwarming, but I think I realised that no matter what they did, even though there was a show of force and a show of love, they couldn't reverse the decision.
Now, just a few months after you were booted out, the Beatles' song Love Me Do became this enormous hit, and then next year they were huge. They were an international phenomenon. You must have been pretty bitter.
I think initially it wasn't so much them becoming the international phenomenon. That was something, you know, the icons in the music industry, this, you know, incredible reputation they acquired. That was something, if you look back in hindsight and you're totally truthful, that was beyond, you know, the realms of our belief at that time. But what the annoying factor was, yes, the self-belief we had in ourselves that we were going to get a record into the English charts was starting to take shape. It was that initial first release. That was the one which started everything. Then, of course, after that, you know, it was followed up with, you know, other number ones. That was where the pain came in, because you were that close to it.
Now, there actually is a recording of Love Me Do when you were still there. You're on the drums. What do you think of the recording that you did?
I've always said it was good. I mean, you know, the version which was released on the anthology after many, many years, it's not a finished version. It was a version which we laid down to give George Martin a sample of the type of music that we were playing, to give him an idea of, you know, the harmonies, you know, there were possible changes which could have been made to it. But it was there. It was basically to turn around and show him that this was the type of music that we wanted to play. This was going to be our first release.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please, love me do.
Now, when the Beatles anthology came out in the mid-90s, it featured 10 songs with you on drums, and I suppose it was maybe the first time when you kind of had official status as being one of the original Beatles. Was that a gratifying moment for you?
It was. You know, a lot of people have always looked at the financial view of it. The financial aspect of it was great. I wasn't expecting it, a little bit icing on the cake.
You got some royalties for the first time.
That's right, yes. You know, after many, many years, I did actually receive something, you know, for, you know, my work as a Beatle, you know, royalty-wise. But the other side of the coin was the fact that Anthology 1, I was on 10 tracks out of 60. It was a little bit like, well, you know, maybe this is their way of turning around and saying thank you for services rendered in the past.
You sort of kicked around for a while, sort of seeing if you could make it as a musician. You ended up working most of your career as a civil servant in the job center there. Were you kind of left alone, or were you hounded at all as being one of the first Beatles?
I think the recognition was there. You know, at that time, I still lived in Liverpool. I still walked the streets in Liverpool. I still drank in the same pubs. When I actually started, it was a little bit of a surprise to people. So, yes, there was an air of curiosity. There was an air of puzzlement. You know, Liverpoolians are outspoken. They'll look across the desk and turn around and say, "Aren't you the so-and-so who played for the Beatles? You know, what the hell are you doing working in the job centre?" And, you know, you explain the position to them, you have a laugh and a joke. And at the end of the day, they realise that, OK, you are trying to, you know, persevere and gain security for your own family.
Now, I understand you are now in your early 60s and you've had a lot of years to think back on, well, over your career, over your life, what might have been if you had stayed with the Beatles. How do you put things in perspective when they became so big, so huge, and you had an entirely different life?
I think it's something you accept. It's something you'd entered into through your own volition. Yes, there wasn't a, you know, there's still an enigma about the dismissal, but you have to adjust your own lifestyle. And I think if you're content with what you're doing, you're pleased with what you're doing, and you're happy with what you've achieved music-wise and what you've achieved family-wise, because at the end of the day, family is number one. You know, if you've provided security for them, you've made sure that they've grown up with a good roof over their heads, they've had a good education, you're proud of your children, they're proud of the parents. I think you've done well, and it's a decision you make. The accolades which come from that are superficial, but it's wonderful to be in a position where you can turn around and say, yes, I've enjoyed life regardless of what happened 40-odd years ago. I've still got my health, I've still got my happiness, I've still got my humour. I'm still respected as a musician, you know, whether it be as an ex-Beatle or Pete in his own right. I've still got a wonderful family. I've still got brothers who stand around me. I've got two wonderful daughters, a wonderful wife. I've got four wonderful grandchildren who I idolise and spoil soft, and most probably always will. I've got a great band, you know, which is doing well. We're accepted, we're pulling crowds in, you know, people are enjoying it. People are starting to talk about the Pete Best Band in its own right. When you put all that together and you put it into perspective, I feel that I'm the fortunate one. I think I'm the lucky one.
You're so young and I'm so old. This my darling, I've been told. I don't care just the what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh,
the song Diana, played by the Pete Best Band. Pete and his brothers Rogue and Rory have put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. It's the story of the Casbah Coffee Club in Liverpool, which will soon reopen to the public. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. There are some lost and found stories you can't forget, like this one. It's about a suitcase that once belonged to a girl named Hannah. She was killed in the Holocaust. The discovery of her suitcase had a profound impact on many people nearly 60 years later.
There are three characters in the story. There is Hannah Brady, who was born on May 16, 1931, in Nové Město, Czechoslovakia, and died in a gas chamber at Auschwitz at the age of 13. There's Fumiko Ishioka, this wonderful Japanese woman who was so dedicated to sharing Hannah's story with Japanese kids that she spent almost a year searching the world for it. And it's the story of George, who is Hannah's brother.
That's Karen Levine, a producer for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. She made a radio documentary about Hannah Brady. And now she's written a children's book called Hannah's Suitcase. Levine told Anne Strainchamps about the remarkable series of events stemming from the discovery of this old suitcase.
Fumiko runs a very tiny Holocaust Education Resource Center for Children in Tokyo, and she obtained a loan of five objects from the museum at Auschwitz: a sock, a shoe, a sweater, a can of poison gas, and the suitcase. And the suitcase, a plain old brown suitcase, had a name on it.
Why do you think Fumiko and the children were so drawn to this simple suitcase?
It was the only object she received that had a name on it. So right there, there was clearly a story behind this particular suitcase. And Fumiko says, and I think she's right, that suitcases represent journeys. And in that sense, it's easy to imagine what might have happened to the suitcase and to its owner. So the kids just peppered her with questions about Hannah Brady. Who was she? What did she put in her suitcase? Where did she go? What happened to her? And Fumiko gives full credit to the kids, actually, for pushing her to go out and search for the story behind the suitcase.
So what did Fumiko do?
She wrote to the museum at Auschwitz where the suitcase originally came from, and they said they knew nothing. She wrote to Holocaust museums all over the world trying to find out any information about this girl, turning up absolutely nothing. And then out of the blue, she received a letter from the curator at Auschwitz saying that they knew one thing, and that was that Hannah had been sent to Auschwitz from another camp called Theresienstadt. And so Fumiko tried a whole bunch of other avenues to try and find more information. And then finally, you know, she threw up her hands and said, I'm going to go to Theresienstadt myself, Theresien, and see what I can find out, which she did.
The amazing thing came when Fumiko discovered that Hannah had had a brother and that, in fact, he might still be alive.
Well, she went to the Theresien Ghetto Museum and ended up finding a woman willing to help her there. They found Hannah's name on a transport list, and Hannah's name had a check mark beside it, meaning that she was killed. In fact, everybody on that list had a check mark beside it except one name, and that was the name of George Brady, which was right beside Hannah's name. The woman who was helping Fumiko said it could be a brother, but she cautioned her because the list was made a very long time ago. Anything could have happened to him. He could have been dead. He could have moved to anywhere in the world. But Fumiko pushed and pushed. They managed to find George's name on another list. And in the most amazing coincidence of all, and there are many, many strange miracles and coincidences in this story, the other list from the boys' home had George's name beside another name, which this woman from the museum recognized. And she told Fumiko that that man was alive and well and living somewhere in Prague. And after much more dogged work, she got to meet that man, and it was that man who gave Fumiko George's address in Toronto.
So in the meantime, here's George Brady. He's constructed a life for himself in Toronto, and he has no idea that a group of Japanese children and Fumiko are searching for him.
No idea at all. And he had constructed a good life for himself in Toronto. He had come here in 1951, having lost all his immediate family in the Holocaust. And he decided he was going to live for the future. And he had four kids, and he built a prosperous business. The one thing he could never deal with was the death of his sister, Hannah. And he suffered horrible nightmares about it all his adult life. And then, out of the blue, comes this amazing piece of mail.
You actually brought in a piece of tape that I think continues this story. This is George talking about that very first letter that he got from Fumiko.
Suddenly, I got a letter from Japan, a big envelope. I was wondering who would write to me from Japan. And when I opened it, I couldn't believe it. I just was stunned. You know, I just couldn't believe it. It's to the credit and incredible perseverance of Fumiko that she decided to find who the owner was, but she did manage.
Right after I went home, I wrote to Mr. Brady, but still at that time, I wasn't sure if I could get any response from him. This might remind him of bitter memories, and he might not want to hear such a thing anymore. But a few weeks later, I got a nice letter from him and details about Hana, and also this beautiful photos of Hana. And I just screamed at that time, and my hands were shaking. And then as I read the letter, it was unbelievable. But what really excited me is that Hana's brother survived. And he now has such a beautiful family. I was so happy about that.
That's George and Fumiko.
Hana and George had been extremely close, weren't they, as children?
They were extremely close. They came from a very happy, quite cultured family, actually. Both the parents were very artistic and athletic people, and they were the only two Jewish kids in the town of Novo Mesto, which was never an issue for them until the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia and things got bad.
What happened?
Restrictions were announced almost every week. Jews weren't allowed to go to parks. They weren't allowed to travel. And one very important moment for George was when he and Hana were going to a movie theater to see Snow White, actually, and saw the sign, "No Jews Allowed." And soon they were barred from going to school, which meant that they lost all their friends, which George says was the most painful restriction. And then in March 1941, their mother was arrested by the Gestapo. And not long after that, their father was arrested by the Gestapo. They were taken in by a very brave Christian uncle, who is the person responsible also for saving the family photographs through the war. And the kids stayed with the aunt and uncle until they themselves were deported to Theresienstadt in 42.
Did they ever see their parents again?
No, they didn't. Mrs. Brady was able to get one letter out. She was sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp, and she got one letter out to the kids. And in the envelope, she had placed four charms that she had made of chewed up bread and toothpaste, with initials of a family member carved into each one. And George still has those charms, which are amazing.
George lost his whole immediate family, his mother, his father, and Hana. And yet it's the loss of Hana in particular that haunted him for so long. Why is that, do you think?
Well, he was the big brother. He felt responsible for her. And even though on a rational level it makes no sense, he feels he failed her. And she was a little girl. As I mentioned, he suffered terrible nightmares all his adult life. And George is a very optimistic, happy, jovial person, remarkably so given what he experienced. But he suffered these terrible nightmares all his adult life. And one of the greatest thrills for me about having written the book is that since the publication of the book, his nightmares have stopped.
It's just such an extraordinary story that children in Japan could care so much and be so curious about one little girl when all they had was her name on a suitcase, that they would hunt all around the world until they reconnected Hana and her brother, in a sense, and made this little girl real and rescued this piece of history. It's just extraordinary.
It is. And the Holocaust is so enormous, not just for kids, for adults too. It's hard to comprehend. It's hard to find a way in. And I think one reason that dumpy old brown suitcase captured the imagination of those kids is because it was a way into understanding a story that is almost impossible to understand.
In Japan, the Holocaust is so far away. Some people don't see any connection whatsoever. But when they look at the suitcase, these children were really shocked that she was my age. And they then realized that there were 1.5 million children like Hana.
Because of the suitcase, it is very strange to me that nearly 60 years ago this tragedy happened, and now suddenly it appears in part of the world where I would have that would be the last place on the earth where I would have expected that it would appear. And it certainly changed a lot of my life and my family, because everybody is affected by it. And my we have a young daughter who is 17 years old, and she's called Lara Hanna, and she is actually going with me to Japan in March of this year, because we would like to meet some of these kids and help them to find a way of changing the world into a better world.
George Brady and Fumiko Ishioka, two of the people featured in the book Hannah's Suitcase. Anne Strangechamp spoke with the book's author, Karen Levine. There is a postscript to this story. A group of eighth graders in a Toronto suburb recently spent months immersed in Hannah's story. They ended up writing and performing this song.
I read a story about a young girl, a true story that changed my world. So many questions still in my mind, with answers I must find. A few pictures give me clues, a few faces that she once knew, a few memories that she embraced in Hannah's brown suitcase. Just a small child.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this hour by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Lost and Found Show, number 83A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.